Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, and art, to talk each week about innovations and progress in the field of social interest design. I'm your co-host, Eric Kessel, and I'm here with my co-host, Emiliano Gandolfi, and each week we're going to introduce you to some of the most inspirational voices in the social design movement. We're continuing our month-long series on Can Design Prevent Disaster? In the wake of seemingly escalating disaster and disaster costs, how do architects, engineers, and designers grapple with a natural environment which is more violent and a built environment which is seemingly more fragile? Last week, we had a great discussion with Dr. Elizabeth Hausler of Build Change, who helped frame up some broad questions and answers about the current state of disaster and resilience. If you haven't listened to the episode, please check it out on our website at currystonedesignprize.com/socialdesigninsights. It makes for a great listen. Today, we're moving to the other side of the planet for a second insight into our question, and Emiliano is going to introduce our guests in a minute. We're hoping to understand how social resilience and physical resilience intertwine and intersect, and what grassroots efforts at disaster prevention look like across the long term. Emiliano, you want to take it from here?
Yes, well, thank you very much, Eric, and welcome to everybody. I'm really honored to be here today with Yasmin Lahri, a really legendary architect based in Karachi, Pakistan. She's the founder of the Heritage Foundation of Pakistan. What is quite interesting for the record is that she's been the first female architect in Pakistan, and she worked in the 80s and 90s as an architect, building some of the largest buildings in Pakistan. When finally she retired in 2000, and devoted her life to on a non-profit organization that she founded with her husband, the Heritage Foundation of Pakistan, in which she was definitely trying to protect all the amazing heritage that Pakistan holds. With this activity, she actually discovered also much more. She discovered the quality of the vernacular architecture in Pakistan. Since 2010, she started working much more in resiliency for victims of floods and earthquakes in Pakistan. Since 2010, she overseen more than 36,000 houses. So it's a quite amazing impact. And what is really peculiar of this kind of architecture is that it's not just building houses, but it's actually helping people with the vernacular knowledge of the building techniques to rebuild their houses, but also looking at upscaling of these techniques through the latest structural verification systems, so to making sure that these systems are safe for prevention of future earthquakes. Actually, Yasmin, I wanted to ask you, how did you started being interested in reconstruction and post-disaster reconstruction? Because, I mean, you come from quite a different background.
It all goes back to the earthquake of 2006 that happened in Pakistan in October, when there's a 7.8, I think it was, a Richter scale, and something like 80,000 people lost their lives. About 400,000 families were actually displaced and were without any shelter. It was a big disaster that we'd never experienced anything like it. Everybody who was in Pakistan just wanted to be up there and to help out in some way. I remember very vividly what happened because I was sitting in the Lahore Fort at the time as UNESCO's national advisor, trying to work on conservation of that particular site. And this happened, and I just kind of, you know, I had to somehow get to the earthquake area. So there was no funding for it. We'd never done any kind of work of that kind. I really had no workforce at the time. I had retired from architecture in the year 2000, and I was working on conservation kind of projects, especially with UNESCO. It was difficult. It was very challenging, but I felt we just got to go and do something. But what is remarkable, of course, with all this is that although I went there with literally no funds, with literally no workforce, but as I got there and started to work, volunteers came from all over the world and also, of course, from Pakistan itself. Materials began to be sent to me. Funding began to arrive. And where I'd gone there only for maybe 3 months, I just kept on working, not only there, but then so many other disasters happened. So it's now become just a normal thing now for us to have a disaster every year. We just expect that. The more I work, the more I get to know how to do these things. I managed to really see much more of Pakistan. I got to know more about our own vernacular techniques and our traditions. And I think that's helped a lot in developing my own design sense. So it's a different ballgame altogether from my earlier work. But I think it's very, very rewarding. And that's what keeps on going, I think. So, yeah, it's been wonderful working in these areas.
Yasmin, you mentioned the pattern of one disaster after another. Do you think that we're collectively, and by we, I mean the architecture and design community, are we getting smarter about how to handle this and how to prevent disaster? And if not, how can we?
Well, you know, this year I was invited to give lectures at the RIBA in London. I was in Oslo and I was in Japan in about two or three places. And I really feel that architects as a community are not able to really understand the challenge that we are confronted with. We all know about Thomas Piketty's, the whole thing about inequality being in every country, basically, whether it's a developed world or industrialized world, is the same story. Accumulation of wealth has meant that everybody's working for that 1% that has everything. And the 99% are largely left behind. And as you also know, architects really want to be, everybody wants to be a star architect and everybody wants to produce iconic architecture, which is fine. But then that means that we are not really concentrating on the kind of challenges that are now confronted by the marginalized communities. Because wherever disasters happen, it's mostly the ones that are affected are the ones who have nothing. Every disaster leaves them even more vulnerable. So if we had more architects working on these themes and these in this kind of field, then I think we'll come up with much better solutions. Because architects are good at finding solutions, but they have to concentrate on this part of the, you know, what's happening in the world today.
Yasmin, what I think is also fascinating about your project is that you're not only bringing your skills as an architect, but you're also bringing your skills into the tradition of the architecture in Pakistan. And you're involving very much the local tradition of citizens affected by disasters to be directly involved. How do you build a civil community that helps you to build these projects?
Well, you know, I was trained in the West. I was trained at the Oxford School of Architecture, and this was, of course, a long time ago. And I came back really not knowing enough about my own country, which was in the mid-60s. And I felt, first of all, I had to learn a lot. So there was a whole period of what I call unlearning of what I had learned, even as I worked with multinationals and corporate sector, because I had to understand where I was coming from. And, you know, Pakistan had been ruled by Britain for the longest time. So most of us who'd been educated in the West had begun to look down upon our own traditions. So it was a huge effort in relearning of what Pakistan is all about. To be truthful, I don't think I really understood until I retired from architecture. Although I had worked with mud a little bit, I'd worked in the informal sector and so on, but, you know, it wasn't really a lot of it. And once the disasters happened, I managed to then really go and study, go and be with people, try and understand what the country is about. I work with a great deal of humility now. As you know, every architect has huge ego, and so did I. I had enormous ego. But then gradually I had to get rid of it, and now I'm just happy to learn from what people do and try to see how we innovate and how we develop it further or try to see that technically we make it better. It's a long learning process, but as an architect, my training as an architect, I think, has helped me. Because, see, the issue, I think, is that design is important. Where there is adversity, where there are lacunae, where there is there are deficits, you need more design and not less. If you're a good designer, you can actually contribute much more for the well-being of the people. I think most architects somehow have not understood. They don't feel that they relate to the poor. But in fact, if they did work in these areas, they will find that it really helps you to grow much more, much better, because you understand the reality much better. And now what's happening in the world with global warming, we know that we have to lower the carbon footprint. And we can only do it if we all do it collectively. And we cannot do it by giving just handouts. We can't do it if we just, you know, get buildings built by contractors. We have to see that everybody starts to understand, how do you deal with disasters? How do you build safer structures? And if they understand, they can do a lot of it themselves as well. And that's where we are after. I mean, my whole strategy now is to train as many as possible, and especially women. Because most of the time, everybody feels women in these countries like mine can't do anything, which is totally, I think, totally untrue. I think women, whether they're the poorest, they're the most non-literate, but, you know, if you teach them something, they will just do it very well. So there are lots of cliches that we have to, I think, you know, we have to really now sort of give up and try to see how we can make people understand, even if they are non-literate, how they can do it better.
That's an interesting perspective, and I like what you had to say about unlearning the contemporary lessons of architecture and Western architecture and architecture school. Can you give us a sense how that philosophy that you just mentioned plays out in the field? You enter into a community, you're seeking to build community resilience, you're seeking to empower women. What is the first step that the Heritage Foundation undertakes?
Well, you know, we've run these programs which are women-centered, community-based disaster risk management kind of programs, which means that you start with women. You go into a community and you gather the women around you and start talking to them, because unfortunately, people are either too scared to talk to poor women, or they don't understand what they are, who they are. So there's very little communication with them. I remember, you know, when we first started in the time of the earthquake in 2006, I decided to hold a meeting of women from all around the area. By that time, we had distributed a lot of material, and we had built quite a few units by 2006. And there was this general, the army general, who was in charge of the area. And he said, "Ma'am, you don't understand. Women don't get out of their houses. They will never come." So I said, "Okay, we'll take the risk." I invited, and you won't believe, something like 700 women turned up, walking something like 2 or 3 hours to get there. And I asked them, "Why have they come?" And they said, "Because we wanted to come and see you, because you've done so much for us." So they came, and then we started these huge programs with the Nokia's funding, actually, at the time, where we trained them or got them to make their bead work, which was sold, and decided to make money out of it. And this just transformed their lives. So it's not that complicated, actually. You just have to have empathy with them. You have to understand what their problems are. You should be able to sit with them on the floor. I mean, you know, you can't speak to them from a height. You have to be with them at their level. And then I think things just happen. They start working.
Yasmin, in terms of reconstruction of communities and villages after an earthquake or a flood, so you first assemble women, which is it seems like the first building block. But then, how do you move ahead? What is the strategy to build in a situation that is certainly under risk of going through another disaster?
We start with actually, telling them how earth can be used for building, which is a material that's common, that's there, that's available. You know, as soon as one of the units is up, people know that it works, especially now that I use bamboo a lot. So the first thing we did, especially in Sindh in 2011, was that we made the bamboo roof and got 15 people to stand on it. And suddenly everybody saw that it was absolutely, you know, strong and safe, because the water couldn't get up to it. And because I use lime, so it really stabilizes the soil. I mean, it's just weatherproof. Any water like rain or floods do not affect it. So once they understand, then they are with us. You have to really somehow get their confidence. So once the confidence is there, then we do work with men as well. But then we start collecting women and saying what they can do. And my best product is the Pakistan Chula, the cook stove, which is now in something like 40,000 of them have been built with no funding. So because I believe in zero carbon and zero funds, okay? Because I feel that we have to stop this whole process of getting donations and then doing things. Instead, we empower people, or we train them that they can do things themselves. So this is an amazing thing where I have got my barefoot entrepreneurs that go and teach. We've taught them how to do it, and they then go and teach housewives build their own cook stoves. And because they're earthen, will literally cost nothing, except they have to pay for maybe 300 rupees for a bag of lime, and 200 rupees or $2 for the person who teaches, maybe a little bit of other materials. And for about $7, you can actually get a cook stove, which is like a little kitchen, which has got an earthen platform. It is DRR, disaster risk reduction compliant. So if we can train people where they can understand how they can do things themselves, it is the best thing, because then they don't rely on anybody. And that's what we have to do, is to tell everybody, you know, become self-reliant. You can do it yourself. That's the confidence we have to somehow build, you know, among them. Because most poor people feel they are helpless. They can't do anything. But that's not true. If you teach them, and they are very, very keen to learn, I think you can do a hell of a lot, actually. I don't think we need any kind of donations if somehow you know, we can spread this whole training mechanism everywhere.
Thank you, Yasmin. What you just said is really quite a statement. Zero carbon and zero funds sounds like a good slogan, but getting to know that you have been building already 40,000 of these stoves is truly impressive. I have been researching your Pakistan Chula Stove project, and what I found incredible is how this project is truly empowering women, creating jobs, and solving a huge health issue related to respiratory diseases. But ultimately, the consequence is also the flourishing of an amazing creative power. These stoves are truly works of art. I invite our listeners to have a look to our website, currystonedesignprize.com, to check the photos that document this amazing project and see how this earth construction drawn from vernacular tradition of Pakistan can be diverse and stunning. We're taking a short break now, but we will be back soon to hear more about the truly inspiring lessons that Yasmin Lari learned through her practice. You're listening to Social Design Insights, a program brought to you by the Curry Stone Design Prize. Next episodes, we'll continue our investigation on Can Design Prevent Disasters? We will be speaking with Shidolai Svanirvar Shangsta from Bangladesh and with Geohazards International from the US, two organizations that have been dealing in an extremely impactful way with climate change and natural disasters. So please stay tuned. We will be back shortly.
Welcome back to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel and Emiliano Gandolfi. Before the break, we managed to cover a lot of ground, discussing how to build trust in community while implementing practical projects like safe building and cook stoves, all in environments that can be constrained in the resources. Yasmin, I wanted to ask, how do we spread that further? One of the things that Emiliano and I were talking about as we were framing up this question and this month was that in a resource-constrained environment, it's hard to make the case for prevention because people say, well, you know, why are we going to spend money on something that may or may not happen in the future? But as you rightfully pointed out, resource constraint can actually be an inspiration for a designer. It can make people more creative and produce better work. So how do we get that message out, perhaps to the design community as well, and tell them that these sorts of environments are crucibles for creativity as long as you approach it in the right way?
Well, absolutely. I think it's very important now for all of us to realize that building industry actually consumes something like 40% of the energy that is used worldwide. And these are figures by UNEP and so on. It uses an enormous amount of water. It's just amazing how much is consumed by the building industry. And the fact is that you do not need to use the same energy consumptive materials that they use in something like steel or cement. You may have to use them somewhere, but not everywhere. And we have to learn to see now how we can really build hybrid buildings. If we can do that, then we start lowering the carbon footprint. And also you start making buildings more economical, which is also, I think, important, especially in countries like mine, because in Pakistan, we have a huge amount of poverty. And unless we teach people how they can build better and safer with the materials that they have available at their doorstep, literally, just with technical competence, how they can improve their living conditions. That is what we have to do. Then we don't need donations. We don't need handouts. We just need to provide them with training and give them confidence. And that is the way to have pride, because I think pride is something important if you want to get results. All of it is possible if they understand that they have an enormous reservoir of design, of techniques, which is the vernacular tradition. You know, normally it's not taken at all seriously. But in all the countries, all of us have vernacular design traditions, which are very, very good. They are good for the environment. They are good for the planet. And that's what we need to promote now.
Yasmin, in your buildings, it seems that there's also a lot of innovation. Can you tell us a bit more about how do you make these buildings safe in terms of new disasters?
But Pakistan is really a place we can learn a lot about disasters, because we are in the path of melting glaciers or on fault lines. I mean, the whole country, most of the country is confronted by these disasters. And so we have to find solutions. See, you can't stop flooding, for instance. You can to a certain degree, yes, but not on a mass scale. And it will take a long time before we can find ways to reduce the flooding. There are some areas in my country which are very close to the river, and they just are inundated every year. And so that's how I got these building on stilts. Now, again, it's not something that I can say that I invented. Stilts have been used for the longest time in many parts of the world. And we just have to see what is it that is good for us. For instance, I promote platforms, but that comes from Mohenjo-Daro, you know, the Bronze Age city that we have, 5,000 years old, that is built on platforms. So there are a lot of examples and instances, you know, in the past that we can now take up and innovate, you know, use them as a basis, but innovate on that. And that's what architects are about, aren't they, really? You know, they are about innovation. But if they could spend their time a little bit towards the 99%, I'd be very happy.
I think we'd all be very happy. I think we're birds of a feather there. I wanted to ask, Yasmin, I think that, you know, there's just this enormous 5,000-year history in many parts of the world that intrinsically created a sort of resilience. People learned how to live in harmony with their environment. And it seems like with the advent of modernism, it spread so fast and so wide. And everybody said, as you said, like all concrete, all steel, all the time. And it really proved to be a system of building that was not sustainable and resilient in many parts of the world. And I appreciate efforts of yourself and other architects who are kind of getting back to this as well. How do we take that work and use it to inform the more commercial forms of development that are happening in cities all over the world? How do we kind of reverse that influence of modernism?
Well, of course, you know, all of us were a product of that age, in a sense, you know, what happened in the 20th century. And it still, of course, is there very much, especially in the industrially developed world, quite a lot in our world as well, in my world as well. But the thing is that now that we see the impact of disasters, the way we see global warming, we have to all change track now. We cannot continue to build the way we did. I mean, what I built in the 1980s, I don't think I would really be able to or would want to do that at all anymore, because the world is changing and has changed. And all of us are now responsible how we deal with whatever we do, especially in buildings, how we build. All of us want to be very creative. All of us want to actually produce iconic architecture. And of course, that is something that we are all trained for. We must do that. But I think we need to have parallel kind of activities going on. We should now try to see what is the impact of anything that we do on the planet, basically. And because materials are very important, we have to see what is sustainable. I don't know whether you know about Hasan Fatihi, who just built in mud in the 20th century. He was amazingly well ahead of his time. And he did that. That was only earth that he used. And that is something, earth is a good material. If you stabilize it with lime, you can use it. So I'm not saying that we should just immediately go in for mud architecture. But I think all of us should be thinking of hybrid architecture. Where, for instance, you might have a frame which might be steel or reinforced concrete, but your infills could be something else, which are more sustainable. So I think there are ways, and that's why I feel that creative architects need to start thinking in this manner, because then we'll find all the different solutions. You do remember Marcus Vitruvius, you know, who used only lime, earth, fire, and air. And these are really good ingredients for contemporary architecture as well. So why don't we think a little bit, go back into the, you know, to the Romans and see how they thought about these things. Because I think the more we learn from history, the more we learn from vernacular traditions, the more we learn actually from, you know, our monuments and sites, there's just so much there that can find or at least give us clues as to the way people did live in a sustainable manner.
Yasmin, I think that's a beautiful place to close, and I think cuts to the heart of the issues that Emiliano and I have been exploring with this program, and the fact that there's physical resilience. I mean, we can engineer a building to withstand disaster, but where architects really need to put their heart and their guts is into social resilience and into building dignity and restoring a lot of these things that perhaps have been stripped out by, you know, aggressive neoliberal capitalism. I'd like to thank you for being our guest. I think Emiliano and I were really looking forward to this, and it's really been an inspiration for you to give us your time and to talk to you about these issues.
Well, let me thank you very much for making me part of this whole process that you have embarked on, because I think it's a very important step. And I do hope that will make a difference in, you know, in thinking and changing the mindsets. So it's a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Yasmin. I think that your words are really inspiring, and they move from the technique and the craft of architecture to the philosophy of the architecture. So really seeing what architecture can bring, not only in terms of shelter, but really in terms of creating relations and creating culture. So really, thank you very much again for your words, and I hope your words will be also contagious.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Hessel and Emiliano Gandolfi. We'd like to thank our guests of the week, Yasmin Ladi of the Heritage Foundation of Pakistan. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Design Prize and the Curry Stone Foundation. For more information on Yasmin and her work, please visit our website at currystonedesignprize.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for all the latest news on social design.